Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called The Celebration of Life. It is the first selection in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Many of you, I'm sure, have heard the saying that mythology is other people's religions. Now, I'm going to ask you in these talks to put yourself in other people's shoes and have a look at your own as mythology. Nietzsche has said, this is the age of comparisons. It works on all levels. And in the realm of what I'm calling mythology, which many people call religions, there are cross-influences operating today that would have been thought impossible 100 years ago. Furthermore, it's good to recall, to remember, that our cultures and our races, the Mongoloid, the Negroid, and the Caucasoid races, are very, very late arrivals in the history of the human species. And we already have very interesting evidence of religious or mythological practices in races long antedating ours. For instance, in the High Alps, that were discovered in the 1920s, in very small caves, right on the level, right below the ice level of the glaciers, little shrines containing the skulls of cave bears. Now, during the course of the last glaciation, the Würm glacial period, those caves were covered with ice. No one could have gone there. And after the time of that glaciation, there were no cave bears in the world. So these little shrines with these cave bear skulls and little fires and little instruments of showing that there had been worship practiced there date from 200,000 years ago. What is this mystery that makes the human species bow before some sign of mystery? Each of us has been brought up in some tradition that has its imagery of that mystery. But the point I want to start out with is that in the human heart and in the human mind, no matter what the race, the culture, the language, the tradition, there is this sense, or at least the possibility of experiencing the sense, of a mystery, and an awesome mystery, and a very terrifying mystery, inhabiting the whole universe, the very mystery of being itself. And here in these very early little signs, these very early shrines, we have the evidence of man 200,000 years ago bowing and asking for something and devoting themselves to something in this way of religion which we continue to know in this aspect, that inflection, and that other throughout the world today. Now, there have been in the past 200 years a great, great many investigations and researches, some of them very pious, some of them very cynical, of the religions of the world, and certain quite constant motifs, basic themes, have come out throughout the whole field. These universals, these continually recurring themes. Also, in each of the various areas, there are quite special, particular inflections, quite different from those in other areas. That is to say, we have this spectacle of continuity and consistency, and at the same time, differentiation. I want to speak tonight in a very general way to the main problems that these situations and these observations bring up. What are the functions, the human functions served by mythologies, by symbolic forms, which have been served, we can now say, for 200,000 years, and have sustained the race, even on the simplest level, and even on the levels of the highest cultures? We all know the greatest monuments, the greatest architectural and art monuments are in celebration of these mysteries. I don't care where you turn. These are the things we now go by jet to see. Let us consider this problem. The human eye opens at a rather late stage in the development of the individual. He has already done the most marvelous work he will ever do. In a mysterious way, in his mother's womb, he has built a human body. And this body has organs that are directed to certain ends and intentions. And these were not the organs designed by reason, designed by consciousness. Reason and consciousness comes to itself and asks later, what is it I'm all about? What is it I am here for? Why is it I do this and that? Furthermore, the coming of the eyes into the human, not the human, the general biological picture is very late. Life had already originated hundreds of millions of years before eyes opened and saw what was going on, saw what life was doing. Now, if you'll see and think what it is that life does, that life has to do in order to be life. It has to kill and eat other life. That's the basic thing. This is a rather monstrous thing. And when the eyes see what the situation is on which its own life depends, its own existence depends, when conscience and consciousness become aware of the preconditions of their own existence, there is often a sense of shock, a sense of horror. You know the basic word of Buddhism, all life is sorrowful. That's one way of recognizing this. There is also the feeling many have of guilt simply for being alive. This is, in a way, symbolized in the image of the fall in the garden. Life is monstrous. Consciousness has other notions of how things ought to be, what virtue is, and so on. One of the problems that man has to face is reconciling himself to the foundations of his own existence. And this is the first function of mythology. That reconciliation of consciousness with the mystery of being, not criticizing it. Shakespeare, in his definition of art in Hamlet, where he says, art, or the art of acting, as it were, holds the mirror up to nature, is a perfect definition, I would say, of the first function of mythology. When you hold the mirror up to yourself, your consciousness becomes aware of its support, what it is that is supporting it. You may be shocked at what you see. You may be greatly pleased. But one way or another, you become aware of yourself. Your consciousness becomes aware of that darkness, that being which came into being out of darkness and which is its own support. The first function, then, of a mythology is the reconciliation of consciousness to the foundations of being and the realization of their mystery as something that consciousness is not going to be able to criticize, not even going to be able to elucidate, not even going to be able to name. It is something beyond naming, beyond all definitions. That's the first point. And when that is lost, one loses this sense of awe, this which Goethe calls the best thing in man. One loses the sense of gratitude for one's privilege of having this center of consciousness aware of these things. The second function of a mythology is to present an image, a total image, of the universe as consciousness is aware of it. We have to encompass the whole of what we know and see that in terms of this mystery. Now, as you immediately realize, in the course of the ages, in the course of time, man's understanding and man's image of the universe has greatly, greatly changed. The view of the world round about that the Pawnee Indian would have had on the plains of Nebraska 200 years ago is very, very different from what is now propounded in the University of Nebraska. A totally new cosmos has come into being, has come into our consciousness. Likewise, when we read in the book of Genesis the story of the creation of the world, that's not the world that our scientists are telling us about. Read an account of the coming into being of the cosmos from the spiral nebulae hundreds and hundreds of millions of years ago and try to bring that into accord with the biblical story, or try to bring it into accord with any of the inherited stories. The image of the cosmos must change with the development of the mind and the knowledge. Otherwise, the mythic statement is lost, and man becomes dissociated from the very basis of his own religious experience. Doubt comes in and so forth. You must remember, all of the great traditions and little traditions in their own time were scientifically correct. That is to say, they were correct in terms of the scientific image of that age. So there must be a scientifically validated image. Now you know what has happened. Our scientific field has separated itself from the religious field, or vice versa. It was actually the religious community that rejected the scientific community in the 17th century. And this divorce is a fatal thing, and a very unfortunate thing, and a totally unnecessary thing. There is no reason whatsoever for clinging to the literal reading of a scientific statement that is 4,000 years old. It must be read another way. and there is something else being said there, which is lost if you either hang on to the old science or reject it. Now, the third function of a mythological tradition is to validate and maintain a certain moral order. Now, these moral orders greatly differ from one society to another. For example, the requirements of a primitive hunting community are very, very different from those of a primitive planting community. What is required of the young men and women when they mature is in each case quite different. Likewise, in a complex society of differentiated tasks with professional doctors, medical men, professional astronomers or scientists, professional governing people, professional trading people, all of these coordinated in one society, we have a quite different social problem, quite different moral problem from that of a simple primitive community. And so there is this variation from society to society in terms of the social orders. Now, some of these social orders are extremely ruthless and fierce in their requirements and extremely narrow in their demands. Individuals may be thus divorced, separated, so to say, from their own nature. Read some of the descriptions in the anthropological works of the primitive initiation rites. What is done to the young people in some primitive societies in order to test their courage, in order to integrate them in the social group? Now, most societies are extremely dogmatic and fierce in their integration of the individual. The individual is born as a separate entity. He is carved up, so to say, and made to fit into a pattern that the society requires. It doesn't require a total man. It requires a part man. Not an individual, but a dividuum, someone who has been divided up and put into a notch. This happens in the most primitive societies already. Nature produces this wonderfully rich being, full of possibilities. The society, and you cannot blame society, it is in a circumstance of its own, requires a certain specific limited type. It's got to have that, otherwise it can't exist, particularly on the primitive levels where the margin for existence is very, very slight. And so the individual is, so to say, carved into shape. Scarified and teeth knocked out, his body is changed so that he'll know, I'm a member of this group, not that group. One of the very important essential ideas in mythology and in the rites of a mythologically based culture is that the individual must be shaped. He must be made to react in the way that that culture wants. And in so shaping the person is removed, so to say, from his own nature. So we have two levels here. The nature level, which all men potentially share, and the local social level. Now, always, as we all know about societies, there is a group that finally gets hold of it and has certain vested interests in keeping things as they are. And when there is a change, when the social structure changes, this group continues to hang on, and it enforces its rights, so to say. And here, right within the social order itself, a destructive, dissolving principle begins to operate. We can see this in the history of religions. One of the great crises, for instance, is the 12th and 13th centuries, when the pattern of early medieval Christianity began to disintegrate because new ideas were coming in. New possibilities were opening up. A much more highly educated and multitudinous elite class was developing, and the old comparatively simple ideas no longer held. There was a terrific fermentation at that time, heresy all over the place. Heresy is the life of a mythology, really, and orthodoxy is the death. The fourth function of a mythology, then, is to center and integrate the individual in relation to himself, the microcosm, in relation to his society, we'll call that the mesocosm, the in-between cosm, in relation to the universe as he's able to know it, and finally, in relation to that ultimate mystery of which I spoke in the beginning. Now let me say a word about the problem of integrating the individual, what the problem is here, because this is the thing that has been the same. Societies have changed, but the problem of the individual in his life course has not greatly changed. The human being is a very strange animal. He matures when he is about 20 years old. He has been growing for 20 years. Most animals, that's the length of a lifetime. So here is a creature who has grown for 20 years in an attitude and in a position largely of dependency, uncertain of himself, turning, particularly in the earlier years, the first 12 or so, to his parents for help, instruction, protection, approval, and punishment. This creates a psychological structure of dependency. The individual is in an attitude of dependence on parental figures. Then we ask him to become responsible, to assume responsibility, grow up. This is the crisis of the transit from infancy to adulthood, from dependency to responsibility. Something has to be done to make it happen. It won't happen automatically, as we now know from the problem of psychoanalysis. A person who looks like an adult, but every time responsibility is thrown upon him, turns around to see where mother or daddy is, just hasn't passed that threshold. A neurotic is a person who is having responses of dependency when they ought to be responses of responsibility. That's all it is. So then he goes to a psychiatrist who tells him, grow up. That's about all the problem is. But that's not so easy. Because after you have, the business of a reflex, stimulus, response. The response takes place. The response of dependence. 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 Now suddenly it's got to be responsibility. And so here it's going, you say, oh gee, look, I'm 30 now. I've got to be over here. And the thing gets mixed up. The primitive and traditional initiation rites have to do with transforming the mode of reaction. Sometimes, and usually terrifically frightening and actually very painful rituals so that the individual will no longer think he's a little boy. There's some rather amusing ones in relation to this from Australia, for instance, where things are pretty fierce. When little boys begin to become a kind of nasty and difficult for their mothers to handle, the women get together and give them a good beating around the legs with sticks and so forth, and then in a few weeks, something very interesting happens. The men, all dressed up in strange, godlike costumes, such as the youngsters have always been taught were the figures of the divinities, they come in with bull roarers and yowls and all kinds of terrifying noises, and the children, the boys, run to their mothers for protection. And the mothers pretend to protect them. And the men grab them and take them away, so mother's no good anymore. Now they have to face this thing. And then what they have to face is really no fun. One of the little crises, the boy is behind a screen of bushes, and a lot of very interesting things are going on outside in the at night, dances and so forth. The boys are told not to look. Well, any boy who does look, can you imagine what's done with him? He's killed and eaten. That is one way to handle juvenile delinquents. Any youngster who will not cooperate with the society that is supporting him is just eradicated. Then he is given a chance to see what's going on out there. So he's sitting, a scared kid, I mean he's about 12 or 13 years old, at the end of this dance field, and it's night, and a strange man comes out performing the myth of the cosmic kangaroo. And this, I'm not kidding. Then the cosmic dog comes out and attacks the kangaroo. This is all part of the mythology of the totem ancestor. And after the youngster has seen this, here he's sitting down the end, as though you were watching a show, you know. And these two big fellows come rushing down the field and jump on the kid and continue to jump on him. Well, now he's going to remember kangaroo and dog forever. This thing is built in. It may not be bright, but they get the point. And there aren't many points to be got.